You're listening to the Polar Bay Book Show. I'm John Boy, and my co-hosts Lee and Megan are in. Good evening, ladies.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, that sounds enthusiastic. Now, tonight, we're varying a bit from the last two shows. We're not actually going to speak about specific novels, but a genre, and our historical novels. It's probably one of, not my favourite, but one of my favourite genres that I like to read. Yourselves, is it, I suppose because of the nature of your employment over the years, you've had to read a fair variety of books, but for pleasure?
Well, I was just saying to Megan off air that I actually, looking back on this, preparing this for tonight, I was thinking, I've actually read a lot.
Yes.
It is something that I have, a genre that I have actually been quite fond of over the years. Like, when I was much younger, I used to read more perhaps than I do now. But I've always found it quite interesting because you get that information about interesting places and times as well as interesting characters.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the... I suppose I've over the years had an interest in history, and it's so long as it's well researched, and I suppose a lot of times it's hard to know you're reading.
I have, I think I've read a lot more of it, but I just consider it good fiction sometimes rather than historical fiction. So looking through, probably read more than I thought, but that thing with them taking that license. You want to have confidence in that they have done the research really well to make sure that it is historically accurate. It's difficult.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
But sometimes, like, it varies so much. I mean, what the definition is of historical fiction?
Well, that was my next question. Now, the co-presenter who's in the room, Brian, I mentioned about, we spoke the other day, Lise, about, and I said to Brian, would you consider, say, Thomas Hardy's work now, even though he wrote his work in the late 19th century, early 20th century, about that time, is that historical fiction? It's historical for us, but our Brian was of the opinion that it probably wasn't. But then, Lee Kelly, you thought it was.
Well, I sort of think that any text that you read where the period in which it takes place is important to the story, and that place is not now.
Yes.
It can almost by definition be historical fiction because it's recreating an environment that no longer exists.
Yeah. So, for you as a reader.
I mean, Thomas Hardy wrote as a contemporary, obviously, but for us, reading that, we get this picture of English life that is beyond the story. It's right. Also sort of enriching us. You know, the one I thought of that might be quite interesting to consider is John le Carré novels, because they're essentially sort of mystery spy type things, but they're a document of the Cold War.
Yeah.
You know, they're...
Well, that's the other question you could ask. How far back is history? Like, in terms... I suppose I imagine historical novels as, you know, 9th century or 19th century, but... Mid-20th century, you know, is Jack Kerouac, The Road, is that almost historical? Because that's I wouldn't think so myself, but...
Yeah, like, if you're going to say Hardy is historical fiction, then anything is, like Austen, Bronte, or anyone writing of their time.
Yeah, well, I would have considered them presenting now as historical novels myself, but... The other argument I got was because they wrote during that time, but to us it's still history, isn't it?
They're historical documents of their time, but I don't think that's historical fiction. You have to be presenting almost a hindsight, so you understand the significance. Where they're just documenting, they become historical documents. But for it to be historical fiction, I thought it would be more them understanding the significance, looking back, like I, Claudius or something, where he's writing well after the time period and looking back on that and seeing much more significance than anyone who actually lived at the time would be able to even fathom.
Yeah, it's true enough.
I reckon, thank goodness we're not librarians, we have to make these genre distinctions, but right. People do get very fussy about their genre distinctions, don't they? Like if you think about the fantasy thing, how you've got to have, you know, quest and the door and all that sort of stuff. But sort of from a reader's perspective, I think if you're just defining historical fiction as texts that are taking place in a different time than now and seek to document that time somehow, that sort of does me, because I reckon otherwise you can be too hung up on the fact that, like some writers of historical fiction, they talk about, like the story's based there. They're not actually trying to come up with a thesis or anything about what that time period was like. They're just giving you the sort of background stuff about, you know, what was it like for ordinary people existing in that sort of environment. You know what I mean? They don't have an historical purpose as such. They're just transporting you to a different place, like fantasy transports you to a different place. It's just that it is actually historic.
Yes, that sounds like a good argument too.
Very postmodern.
Except, you know, the only time we kick them out is if they get it wrong.
Yeah, well, that's true.
If their histories, you know, they make mistakes. And
I suppose, especially, say, a modern writer writing history, as a lay reader, you just don't know, do you?
Yeah.
I read, it's interesting you say that, and I'll mention this particular author, Alfred Dugan, or Duggan. He was one of the first historical writers I ever come across in the 70s. He died in 1964, so all his work was written in the 50s. And this one is The King of Athelney, which is about Alfred, set in he's King of Sussex, King Alfred. Great. I reread it because of this program, and it's fantastic. But he does mention berserkers in the war band of the opposition. Now, I have read that they didn't exist at all. It's
a myth.
A myth.
So we'll have to kick him out because he's wrong.
Well, a lot of, you read a lot of, well, you know, the, I suppose, battle scenes and that of a lot of the these particular fictions. They always mention berserkers. And I did read in a historical book of war, I think, that it's just a fiction. There's no credible documentation that they actually existed in any armies in medieval Europe. So just a small point.
But it's just the whole perception of them. Like, you imagine if you're being attacked, they're berserkers to you.
Yeah, but this bloke, and I've read a few, they were a band, the berserkers were, you know, they were pushed in first because they were mad and crazy. But, I mean, they're obviously mad and crazy.
I
think you have to be, especially in those days.
I think there's actually quite a distinction within the genre. Like, obviously, that writer's trying to write about, you know, a whole sort of plethora of events, and you know, so he's got a few things mixed up. Whereas other people don't, they set a great yarn in an historical period. You know what I mean? And it's different because then that. We're not reading them as history.
No,
we're reading
right.
them yeah. as fiction
mm. yeah.
because it's an interesting time, and we're wanting to, you know, pick up. I mean, I'm sure you picked up plenty.
Oh well, exactly right, and this, like, you know, he the conversations about certain things that happened historically. You've got no idea what they would have discussed.
Yeah,
yeah, really. you know, he's. In this particular novel, you know, he's talking to a Welsh monk, and they're talking about, you know, his who should be the head of the throne and duty and all this stuff. Well, you've got no way known from history whether, you know, these things were discussed at all. But I suppose that's, you're a fiction writer, really.
Yeah,
and,
as long as you keep within the bounds,
you know,
of what's plausible, you know.
And quite often in the backs of any novel, I'll say, you know, this is, you know, based on these events happen, but
drawn from these other texts,
And that's, I suppose, it's all you can do as a writer.
Mm.
Okay, can you actually remember your first, I realise you've read a lot of novels, but can you go back to what would have got you interested in historical novels? Because I can. strangely enough.
Well, I can remember as in year 12 doing history, European history, and I got interested in Jean Plaidy novels, and she used to write about, you know, the Tudors and War of Roses and things like that. So that was for me. And then I had this series, I've actually brought a few in tonight just in case anyone gets wildly interested in them, called Poldark, that I was reading when I finished uni. I used to read them in the summer holidays, and there was 9 in the series. I think I got interested in them because there was a BBC TV series. Anyway, last year they reissued another BBC series of Poldark.
Right,
so I went back and reread all 9 because I thought it might have been just a teenage fancy, but I actually really enjoyed them. And then I discovered, this was quite funny, that I'd stopped reading them because I'd gone off to work, but he kept writing them. So I discovered there were 3 more.
Right.
So I sent off and got them and read them. So I've done the whole 12.
Oh.
But I was thinking about what I liked about them, and it is an exposure to an environment that that is really different. But one of the other things I thought which was interesting about it is the landscape in Graham Winston's books. Just beautiful description
right.
of the Cornish environment.
Yeah.
And then it's got all the elements of a story. You know, there's a sort of, well, he goes off to fight in the American War of Independence because he's a sort of a bit headstrong and impulsive. And when he comes back, his girl's married the other guy.
Oh, no.
And his dad's died.
That doesn't happen much in fiction.
You know, the family homestead's gone to rack and ruin. So it's basically a family saga. But it's just that I found that the environment and the landscape so wonderful to read about. And there's a couple of characters in it that have, you know, real Cornish accents. And he tries to write that, so, you know, phonetically, so you can read it.
Oh, yeah.
And I love that, just the village life. And
yeah.
So I reckon
that's probably why you like Thomas Hardy as well.
Yeah, yeah. No, just, you know, I reckon any writer that can transport you into a world other than your own, so you're there, you know, you're reading it and you can imagine this, is really powerful. And I really like that series for that reason.
Yeah.
Well, if we're considering Hardy historical fiction and that whole thing, it's probably really captured by something like To Kill a Mockingbird, or, you know, even if I'm Steinbeck of Mice and Men, going back to that complete different era Depression.
Yeah.
And but I not considering them really historical fiction.
No.
I couldn't say what I first picked up, but I loved probably recently The Red Tent, which I probably read in like the last 10 years, which I hadn't read anything of from that era, and it was like reading the period of the Bible, but from a woman's perspective. And just
right.
you
so what century was that set in?
It's the Kingdom of Solomon, and but following just this nomadic sort of family, and it was just really interesting because you know, you read the very dry Bible, which is very different, but
oh, that's interesting. I might be a bloke thing, but I sort of like the sword fighting ones. In the 70s, I was given a book called The Crystal Cave by a woman called Mary Stewart, an author, and it was about King Arthur. Now, it's a bit like Lord of the Rings. Not quite historical, but this was actually, there's no myth in it at all. She wrote 3 novels, Crystal Cave, Hollow Hills and The Wicked Day, which is the story of Arthur. And her Excalibur was an old Roman sword, and it was just encased in ice in a cave. And Merlin was just an advisor. And I haven't reread them in over probably 40 years, which I got them at home. They might sound, but that really got me interested in just historical novels and reading that type of thing. And
saying that, you know, that capturing of your imagination, you know, so that you're in that world, you know, that's one of the joys of all reading. But Meg and I were just talking about Kate Grenville's novel, The Secret River, as an historical, and I, novel, and I reckon that's a really good example of where this genre can be so good, because a bit like To Kill a Mockingbird, it's got timeless sort of themes that it wants to discuss, yes. And very contemporary, really, to look at, you know, our relationships with the Indigenous population of Australia. But she sets it in this historic time, and you know, the origin of the story was that she discovered she had a relative who,
that's right.
Who'd been transported from England, and he'd been a boatman, and she wondered what it would be like for him to be there. And I think that's fantastic. It's, you know, like, such a great way to explore the idea of why did people behave the way they did in that early settlement.
Yeah, no. You know, I have read that book.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. And I loved it. It was very personal.
Mm.
Yeah.
But I loved it seemed around the same time that watched things like Deadwood or, you know, those HBO series that were so well produced, and they were all focused on the gold rush in America, but showing the harsh reality of how they really lived. I mean, like Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven film, that dirty realism that really was missing from the dry historical document suddenly gives it much greater life as a reality.
And, you know, fantastic to, you know, for people to question what they would do in a situation like that, because it's very easy to look back retrospective and
that's
say,
right,
you know,
and say, oh,
no,
I would
have been brave. Yeah. I would have been a good person.
Yeah.
But
no, that's right. And it, that the fella, isn't it, like, he's basically a good man, but...
Thornhill? Was it?
Yeah.
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 But then you've got that Smasher character as well. And
oh, yeah.
But you could imagine people like that.
The extremes, living side by side.
Yeah,
and
the extremes of humanity in an alien place, really.
Mm. So there's a great scene I really remember out of that book where he's picked out his plot where he wants to build his house, and his wife's there with the children, and the Indigenous people are gathering in the background, and she's really, what are they doing? Get them out of here. You know, and because you've travelled with their journey, you understand how valuable this land is to them, because this is what they've fought for since they've come out from England. But you've also got that perspective of the Aboriginal people and understanding that this is their always land. Place, you know.
Yeah.
That sort of historical fiction has got so much to offer now. I think.
True enough. Another author I really like... I might have mentioned, he's still alive and writing, and Claire, my daughter, put me onto this. It's Bernard Connell, and he wrote a series of called The Grail Quest, and it's just about a poor Englishman who becomes an archer in, I think it's Edward III's army at Agincourt, and how he, and his descriptions of the battles are just, and just the average person, it's just horrible, like... He's obviously done he writes quite a lot of historical books. There's a series called Sharp, and he's a soldier in the English army against Bonaparte. He's written, I didn't get right into them so much, but this quest, and he's written one about Arthur as well. He's still writing, but I just fell in love with this series of just this poor archer and his descriptions of the battles of, you know, you can only imagine what they'd be like, but he doesn't glorify it, and how they, you know, they have to get drunk to fight the average soldiers, and how, you know, Agincourt, really, they were lucky. It's held up in English history as the archers killed, but it was just luck of the day. You know, there was wet ground, and so, you know, he describes all this and how, you know, they got to hide. It would rain, so they have to hide their, you know, strings. And, you know, I just love the way this bloke writes his history. And he's obviously, from what I can gather, he's done an amazing amount of research. And so
it's interesting. We've got quite a range of tastes. And we've gone
the Cornish
countryside. You like the battles, John? I can tell.
Well, exactly, and it sort of plays on a bit. I like the Master and Commando, the sailing. Mm. Alexander Kent's another, not so much well known as, you know, but he, about, I suppose it's the 18th century British Navy things.
I've got a bit of a soft spot too for the British Raj. I like things to do. Yeah. There's been a series on the ABC at the moment called Indian Summers.
Yes,
I don't know if that's similar.
Yeah.
But there's quite a few historical fiction set in that time that I've really liked, like Dominique LaPierre, I think her name is, 5 Minutes to Midnight or something, and she tells the story about India just at the time of partition, and she has the sort of character in that sitting up in his motel room trying to decide, now where will I draw the line for Pakistan and where will I draw the line for... But, you know, somebody did that, actually, and so... That's what I really like about that genre. Like, you just imagine somebody, you know, would have that sort of sense of, I'm doing something really significant here, but I've only got these factors that I can take into consideration. I've got to do it, you know. And then, of course, it follows on with the consequences, the dreadful consequences of what happened.
Is that romantic quality too, when those periods of time are lost or gone? So they're writing of...
Yeah.
A society that really doesn't exist anymore.
It's been gone. And we tend to look back at, I suppose anything historical is a bit romantic, or we can, I think.
Well, there's lots of young adult fiction, or probably younger too, isn't there, that tries to do this with history, tries to make
horrible
kids,
histories is quite good.
Try and make kids, you know, the centre of a story about... you know, I remember there was one had in the library at Apollo Bay about Cyclone Tracy, and where they sort of try and write things like
Jackie
like
French
kid.
Did that quite often. Yeah. There was Hitler's daughter, and there was a there was a series, and she always put a child sort of in the role. But a bit like Anne Frank, you know, he's coming.
Well,
we could
go there, although we do have
that's
that
not
problem.
Really fiction, but yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's totally off the subject, but we were in a bookshop in Geelong the other day, and in the young, we're buying for my 11-year-old niece, and the boy in the striped pyjamas was in that section. Now, I haven't read that, but I didn't think that was a young adult novel, or unless they've abridged it.
It'd be that. Where would you put it?
Oh, I haven't really read. I just assumed it was an adult book.
No.
But I know it was about young, a couple of kids either side of the
fence. Yeah, and I think
it's
like the Jackie French thing, putting a child in the centre so that kids can read about it and relate
and learn
to the story.
A bit of history, that was just having not read it, but read a lot about it, I thought, But
that could almost be like a subgenre, couldn't it? That war historic fiction,
would
All Quiet in
the
Western Front, and those sort of things, where you try and, I mean, all the parameters are known, you know, the outcome, etc., and all you're doing is creating a character, and imagining their motivations as they live through those events.
Yeah, the other series of, I suppose, they are historical novels, very popular fiction at the time. Was The Man in the Iron, Alexander Dumas' Musketeer.
Oh, yeah.
And he wrote, I'm not sure, but did he write those at the time, I think?
A little after, I think.
And I read those because I've watched every bloody Three Musketeers movie.
Yeah, because they had swords in it.
Because they had swords in it. And the books were nothing like the movies. But they're very simply written. I found... I read The Three Musketeers, The Man in the Iron Mask, and I think there's three of them. I'm not sure which the other one was. But I thought they, like the other one, you read Rob Roy, and I found that really hard to read, possibly because of the language. But it was very...
That's
it
interesting.
Was almost, you could almost see he's playing for the... it's like, you know, the News Corp of the day. In his novels.
For the masses.
Yeah.
But translated too, though. So it could have been translated for the masses.
Yeah.
As
I really enjoyed
them
because they were different to the movies and that cavalier style. But they're a bit darker than most of the movies and television series.
But I think we could take up that argument, couldn't we, about film versus book? But
leave that for another program.
Well, I think historically. In terms of history, the novels have committed much fewer sins than the films.
Oh, yeah.
When they do the historical events. Oh, yeah. Because that's it's sort of like when they do a film based on a historical event, they take so much license to make sure their character's heroic or, you know, that there's an outcome in such a way that they do just, you know, they stretch the facts to suit themselves much more than novels do, I think.
It's interesting you say that. On movies, the new Miles Davis movie that's just been released, Don Cheadle, they had to, I was reading the other day, they had to write in a white actor to get funding to make, and that was Ewan McGregor.
Mm.
He's a down and out journo, evidently, but that character had to be written in before they could get funding because it was about, I assume, because they don't like jazz or think there's money in it, or because it was about an African-American.
Were there not any white musicians that Miles Davis played with?
That's what I would have thought.
Yeah.
I would have thought there'd be lots of them. Well, John Coltrane and all those. But
That's odd.
Yeah.
That's
Hollywood.
That's Hollywood.
I read a really good review of that film, The Man Who Knew Infinity, you know, about the mathematician.
Yes, that's right.
And basically the review was saying that it's such a shame that they butchered the truth to try and make a good story, because the real truth was actually more interesting than the story they ended up telling.
Like, what, not a happy ending or something?
No, just the idea that I think they sort of subsumed facts to make it more dramatic in the film. Like, they made out that he was not known at all before he left India, and that wasn't true. And so lots of things that they did to dramatise it that they didn't need to do, because the story was rich enough.
It's really interesting. Mm, I read that too.
They just sort of get too focused on what the entertainment value is going to be.
Yeah. You're right, I suppose. But that's movies, isn't it? and as I say, there's a whole show in movies or books to movies.
Yeah. But also, if you think about it, like a book allows you more time to digest things, doesn't it?
That's so right. It can be as long
as your concentration span is greater when you're just sitting there as an individual reading something, whereas in a film, I guess they've got to keep it moving.
One advantage is, I suppose, that if it's the first book you've picked up from that historical period and you don't know a lot, visually you would get a lot more, because a lot would be presupposed that you actually do know from that era or that time, whereas visually that can be just fed to you.
That's right.
And there's been lots of great films that try and do that, you know, just bring that sort of history to life. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people think of Pearl Harbor in terms of the movie.
That's right. And I suppose a lot of, well, say the historical novels, I like to read, as you know, fairly older sort of stuff. I think someone mentioned Geraldine Brooks the other day. I have not read any of her books. Mm. Have either of you read any of her novels?
Yeah, I've read several of hers. She's got a new one out that's getting good reviews, but I haven't picked that up.
Do they, I might be just saying this because I'm assuming she's a female writer. Her character is mainly from a female perspective.
No. One of her most famous ones is March, which is the story of, this is another good example of historical fiction. It's the father from the book Little Women, right? So she's taken that sort of little imaginative hole that's there, and she's created this character, and she tells all the story of his soldiering and
Civil War.
Yeah, she sets that in an historical period, but it's clearly in it. A character she's created.
Yeah.
Mm, I really liked The Year of Wonders purely because it does take the role of a young woman as the narrator, and it's just that voice that you don't normally hear about from that period of history. Everything was written by men, at all. But her other, I loved People of the Book, which she actually just goes through the history of a book and how it's been rebound, and it's gone through multiple generations and different owners. So the narrative changed all the time.
I must get hold of some. Mm. Well, on that, you've just finished reading the Bring Up the Dead by Hilary Mantel, and because that's
great.
I love both those books as well.
I think they're, you know, like the pole duck things, if we just go back to that for a second, this has been so long on it, they're not literary books. They're just a story that you get, you know, interested in. But I think Geraldine Brooks and also Hilary Mantel, they're a class above in the way that they write, in that they're really bringing, you know, multifaceted characters alive, and they're doing much, much more than just recreating an environment. Funny story about Hilary Mantel, though. There's a third one about Thomas Cromwell that she's supposed to bring out, but she hasn't published it yet, as far as I can gather. But there's a review being written on it on one of those websites. Somebody's obviously just done it as a bit of a joke. But, you know, it's got everybody's really angry that, you know, that somebody could have done that, you know, put up a review for it.
For a book no one's read. It's
even written. And she published another book in between, about that one about Margaret Thatcher. I don't know what the name of it is. But all her fans are really angry at her because they're waiting for this third book.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting?
But maybe they can only write, like you're saying, if they're a different class, they can write like that because of series like The Pole Duck that sort of, you know, I mean, because originally I don't imagine it sold. People wanted to read about Biggles, not the reality of war. They wanted
exactly
the idealised history, not the
truth.
And,
I mean, I have, because I review books on my other radio show, I did review a Biggles novel, and certainly not historically correct, Biggles in the Pacific, I can tell you, in the Second World War or whatever it was. It's almost what you would call a very shallow story. But you can understand, especially, I suppose, for younger readers, I don't know, was that the target for that sort of genre of books?
Well, there has been. I mean, there are, like I said about that Cyclone Tracy one, there are, you know, books that are published just because they're trying to entice younger people into reading something.
But, I mean, when was Biggles published? Because
20s?
Yeah, it would have.
Like, very early, but I'm assuming it had a long life
as well. There was a hell of a lot of them published. Mm.
But I don't imagine you can revisit it like Tintin and see much to it or much depth as,
And look, I've only read the one, and it was only about 2 years ago, I don't know, but come across it at home somewhere. Mm. And it was, Biggles was in the Pacific, of course, and you could look at it from a historical perspective. Perspex, that's plastic stuff. But it was set in the 20s, and horribly racist attitude towards the island, the people, and you're going, geez. But that was the time, I suppose. And
I suppose that's what I mean by writing, if you're documenting of the time, that significance of the time is lost. We've just done Lord of the Flies with my Year 8 class, and there's one use of the N-word, and I asked the students, you know, the author is aware of the power of the word because he only uses it once, but he uses savages constantly.
Yeah.
Mm. So what does it do to a modern reader hearing a word like that? And do you think at the time, yes, it was racist and would have been heard a lot and acceptable, but even the writer knew at the time it was racist. Yeah. And has used it very sparingly, whereas Biggles, you know, was purely just like pandering to popular kind of ideas.
And the Pacific Islanders were just that typical of, you know, virtually Ooga Booga sort of. It really was.
Yeah.
And the pidgin English they spoke. And
bone through the nose, the whole.
Pretty well.
Yep.
You're going, oh, jeez.
Well, that's probably another thing, you know. Perhaps in a few years' time they'll be reviewing things that were popular now, like colouring books, and going,
Fifty Shades of Grey.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, it is, it is an interesting way of, like, I suppose a modern writer wouldn't put that language into a historical novel now, but...
Or if you did, you would deliberately make a character racist.
Yeah, like, that's right. Because if you were writing, say, about the American Civil War or the slave, I can imagine the language used by the white slave owners would be horrific to hear. But you'd want to put it in the novel, surely.
Yeah, to be accurate.
To be accurate.
Yeah.
I think, unless you're terribly politically correct and you wouldn't do it, but I don't know. It'd be interesting.
Well, then you'd get slammed for not being historically accurate. But yeah,
it probably comes back to what the author's purpose is. You know, really, like if you think back to Biggles, it probably was just a ripping yarn for a young lad.
that's right. But it is interesting. But I suppose on that, would you call, say, the Poirot Agatha Christie's same, could you look at them as a historical novel now? Same argument, they were written in the 20s. But once again, they stand up, her novels, are like Poirot stuff, stands up really well. I read one not long ago because we've got a heap. I read them. One of the reasons I got into reading as a teenager was, I might have said to Lee, I was at school, didn't read much, and someone gave me a James Bond in the 60s, and I just engrossed, and the librarian at the time ridiculed me because it wasn't proper literature, but it got me reading.
Mm.
Then I read Tarzan and the Apes and Edgar Rice Burroughs stuff and loved Doug. Fantastic early work.
We can all drag out skeletons from the I read Trixie Belden.
But, and then that's when I got on this Mary Stuart stuff, and it just, and I was always, as a kid, I loved history.
Mm.
And, I still do, I suppose.
Yeah. I would say no to that about the Poirot series and Agatha Christie, because the main thing that she's trying to do, her purpose is to create a mystery.
The
setting is, you know, it's part
just
of
background.
It's not, she's not, like, the thing about historical novels is they have long passages where the writer is actually trying to recreate an environment for you. You know, it's not necessarily driving the story forward. It's putting you in a place. And so I don't think that's what drives her books. I think it's the mystery that drives it.
Yeah. No, that's fair enough too. You are listening to Apollo Bay Radio 87.6 on your FM dial, 3ABR, if you're listening, Claire, in the UK. I think she tuned in last week. Now Monique's at the microphone. How are you today, Monique?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. Now, what have we got to talk about from, say, a younger reader's perspective today? Historical?
No, not historical, completely fiction. I've got a book called We Were Liars by author E. Lockhart, which was published about 2 years ago and that I read last week. To talk about.
Oh, so you read that in a week?
Under a week, about 3 days.
Oh, don't brag. Okay, can you? It's taken me 2 weeks to read my one for the.
It's pretty short.
My eyes are a bit. So, what's it about?
It basically follows. It follows a family, and they own an island, and they visit every summer. So I've written here, if I were to rate it, I would rate this book 100 out of 10. I found the writing style was really unique. And
who teaches you maths?
The writing style was really unique and slightly old-worldly. The plot line was really thrilling and suspenseful and addictive. All the characters had their flaws and significant roles, but they did it in an extraordinary way, and it didn't take long for the readers to feel like they wanted the characters a part of their life. They weren't really everyday, they were more upper class and part of a bloodline which was really all too important for their own good. The setting was USA in Massachusetts, which, like I said, an island the family supposedly own, and there are only four houses on the island, one for each daughter, and then their extended families to live in. So the story basically follows the cousins, so the children of each daughter, which visit every summer as a tradition and create their own fun on the island. The club nickname is Liars, which refers to the firstborn. There's four that make up that group. And I've just included a few quotes that I wanted to read out that I really liked. The first one was, "There is not even a Scrabble word for how bad I feel," which is said between Candace and Mirren, the cousins, when tension surfaces and their mistakes begin to divide them. The next quote was, "Silence is protective coding over pain," which I believe really suits the family's way of dealing with their suffering. And then the final quote was, "We are liars. We are beautiful and privileged. We are cracked and broken." And I feel this very simply, directly sums up the book's purpose, which is to express that even the most well taken care of financially and otherwise kind of families still have their own pain.
Ah, sounds very deep and meaningful.
Yeah, it was. There's good. A big twist that happens towards the end, which I wasn't expecting.
Right.
Which
and
I feel like
give
I'm.
Away.
Yeah, I'm still not over it, to be honest.
Oh. Yeah. Geez, you take your books personally, man.
I do. I really do.
So you found the characters easy to relate to, even though they own an island. Like, they're obviously in a different stratosphere socially.
Yes. Well, they weren't relatable in the kind of way that most characters are, because they weren't ordinary kind of everyday teens, but they had their own kind of traits.
Personally, they were written well, though. You could have. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and they were all very different, but somehow they kind of worked well as a group.
So, had someone recommended this book to you?
Yes, actually, my friend Lauren from the United States had recommended it for me.
Right.
Yeah, she really loved it. So we've debated back and forth about the occurrences of the book.
Is she tortured by it like you
yes.
are?
Yeah, okay. Yes, which is very good that I have someone to rant to about this kind of thing. Yeah, she said that, I think she said it was haunting, but it came together in a really unified way that gave her closure more so than it gave me. But
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds really good. Yeah. Actually, funny enough, my daughter, Claire, most of you know, a few months ago, she gave me actually some young adult fiction to read, one book, and it would be, fantasy. It's called Mortal Engines. I ended up reading the whole five books. It was fantastic. it was different. Like, it was, if we do have a... maybe we could do a book review or book subject on fantasy novels, but it was really just so different, a sort of concept, I suppose, and set millenniums in the Falklands and whole cities travel around gobbling up. It's English, but it was she had the whole, I don't know how long, I mean, she's in her 30s, so I don't know whether she just read them or had them since she was a young adult, but they were fantastic range. I think there's about five books in all. It was good fun. Yeah. And I think I've read a few sort of young adult books through her.
Yeah, so sometimes it's not fair that they're targeted as if it's a...
I wouldn't.
It just doesn't fit either category. I mean, they're fine as adult...
They're adult
fiction.
Books, yeah.
If they're well written, they're well written.
It's just fiction. It's just literature, isn't it? Yeah. But I suppose that's a lot of literature is in that. It does get labelled as not considered literature. Some of the your 50 Shades of Grey, I suppose.
Yeah, but that changes with time too. Like you said, you're a librarian turning your nose up at your James Bond. And
that's right. Yeah. And I suppose, and in a sense, your Biggles would be in that too in its day. I don't know whether it would be called, whether they were sort of like the, I can't describe, but just your cheap novels that were banged out.
The pulp,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, probably hipsters out there collecting them now as vintage pieces.
Yeah, well, probably.
Have you read more of that writer? Have you really enjoyed it?
No, but I really want to.
Yeah.
I looked into her. She has another book which she collaborated with other authors called How to Be Bad, so I'm looking to get that.
She's got some very negative titles.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
So that's pretty well our show for tonight. I'd like to thank... co-hosts, Megan and Lee and Monique. Next week's show is John Banville, and the Untouchables will be dissected, no doubt. So thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. Don't forget Radio Caroline's on tonight. And keep reading, because it's good fun. And plenty of historical novels out there to be read. So, okay, good night, everyone. And we'll see you next week with probably Brian in the chair.